Well, thanks for coming, everyone. Welcome to the this session. My apologies, it's not going to be as advertised because next week on Tuesday there's a day's conference on the Nature Tantra we're having. So I was going to give a lecture on the Nature Tantra, but when I saw that they were so close to each other, I decided to do lecture 4 this week. So it should be called lecture 3. But so I've got to swap them round. I might not do the Nature Tantra for the final one, but I'll see. But well, so this week I'm going to look at non-dual Shaivism. It follows on from the Shaiva Siddhanta that we looked at last time. So last week we looked at the Shaiva Siddhanta and the dualist tradition and arguments for the existence of God. And if you remember, the Tantric Shaivism is the Mantra Marga, the path of mantras. And Mantra Marga's got two bits to it. One is the Shaiva Siddhanta, which is the backbone of the Tantric tradition, and the non-Siddhantika traditions, which has comprised various different sects, if you like, or cults, if you want to call them that, like the Trika, like the Krama, like the Kula. And the recognition school, what I want to talk about today, comes out of that non-dualist Shaivism. So the non-dualists, Shaivas, say that they have a separate revelation from the dualistic Shaivas, which they call the Advaita, the non-dual revelation, and that that they say that supersedes the earlier thing. And according to Alexis, though, the core text of the Trika, the Malini Vijayotara Tantra, was originally a dualist tantra, which gets colonized, as it were, by the non-dualists. So anyway, the recognition school comes out of that, and it succeeds in being kind of non-sectarian, and it uses the language of the Pramanas, uses the language of Indian philosophy to present its views. And like other schools, it operates through commentary on scripture, on commentary on revelation. There are some independent treatises. And you know, we call this idealism. Idealism being the claim that the external world exists only in consciousness, and that is contrasted to realism. So I think that's not a bad description of some of these traditions. But we do have a problem of reading into India Western philosophical categories. For example, the categories of substance and essence have equivalents in Indian philosophy, dravya and svabhava, respectively, and these terms were translated into Chinese through Buddhism. Ji jing, I don't know Chinese. Jing is nature, I know, and ti, respectively. Now, similar philosophical problems are addressed in distinct civilizations. Though I think that's interesting that realism and idealism are Western categories, but I think that they exist across civilizational boundaries. So a weak sense of idealism is that the world cannot be accounted for independently of the mind, and that's quite common in Indian philosophy, it seems to me, being a key idea in the yoga traditions, and a strong idealist thesis that the world itself is consciousness was developed by both Hindu and Buddhist philosophers. So you've got a weak sense of idealism and a strong sense. Weak sense is pretty common, I think, but the stronger sense is less common. Now, Buddhist idealism in turn influenced China, where Chinese forms of idealism emerged, which are not the topic of this talk. So idealism, we've got the necessity of involving consciousness in any account of reality took two major forms. One is that reality itself is identical with consciousness, which is a strict non-dualism. And the other is that the reality is an emanation or manifestation of consciousness, which I've called emanationism. So I think that they're not the same, and that it's very difficult to consistently maintain a language of strict non-dualism because it falls very easily into emanationism. Okay. The origins, so within Vedanta, we do get a pure non-dualism with Advaita Vedanta, and along with a modified or qualified non-dualism in philosophies such as Vishishtadvaita, to a non-idealistic philosophy of dualism in Dvaita Vedanta that posited an unbridgeable ontological distinction between self, God and world, as we had last week with the Shaiva Siddhanta. So Moving on quickly to the Pratyabhijna, the recognition school. The origins of this are traced to Somananda, whose dates are about 900 to 950, then Utpaladeva, Abhinavagupta, and Kshemaraja. So those are the big key names. If you like, if you remember last week, we had many more Shaiva Siddhanta theologians, from Sadhya Jyoti to Ramakanta and Bhujadeva. So here it's the main ones are the main names. So the soteriological life soteriological goal of life is for the self to recognize itself as pure consciousness, which is a liberating cognition. So it's not just supposed to be an intellectual exercise, it's kind of philosophy as a way of life. It's supposed to be understanding that this cognition, this recognition, has an existential impact on you and has a liberating effect. It burns off your karma, as an image that Abhinavagupta uses, as a spark thrown on a pile of cotton burns it all up. So the sudden recognition of your identity with consciousness burns up your past karma. And the recognition of this realization of the ontological identity of consciousness with its object therefore entails that there is nothing which is impure. So Kshemaraja, in his commentary on the Spanda Karika, says there is no tattva which is impure, there is no reality which is impure. And there are influences on this Pratyabhijna from Buddhism, Dharma, Kirti, and the Vijnanavada, philosophy of grammar, Bhartrihari. And really, it reaches its kind of acme in the final work of Abhinavagupta, the verses on Utpaladeva, the Ishvara Pratyabhijna Vimarshini, who had called his philosophy, Utpaladeva called his philosophy, unusually, a new way, Margo Navaha, a new way. So that's very unusual, because usually they want to say, no, this isn't new at all, this is old as the hills. So this is quite original. It's original, and he claimed me to be original. Now, Abhinavagupta responds to this, and according to Ratia, he doesn't add much to Utpaladeva. So probably Utpaladeva is the genius of this tradition, and Abhinavagupta is the consistently applies this insight to these different fields of Indian thinking. So, and he particularly responds to Buddhism in that last work. And he follows the standard pattern of initial statement or thesis challenged by an opposing view, the Purvapaksha, which itself is then critiqued in a process resulting in a demonstrated conclusion, a Siddhanta. Siddhanta is demonstrated conclusion. Now, following Utpaladeva, the thesis he presents is that a person and world in reality comprise the pure consciousness of Shiva. This is an idealism that privileges consciousness while not denying the reality of the world. It's not that the world is an illusion, as it is for Advaita, but that its substance is consciousness. So I think they're different positions. It's not that the world is unreal, but its substance, what it's made of, is consciousness. This is soteriologically important because seeing self and world as consciousness results in liberation. So we see the world as consciousness. So Bhairava, in the iconographic descriptions of Bhairava, according to Alexis, he's got bulging eyes in which he's moving out into the world and consuming the sensual experience, consuming experience through the senses. So it's a bit, he's a kind of early William Blake, you know, the world of excess leads to the palace of wisdom, is Blake. So that's a kind of 18th century Christian tantrism, if you like. So Abhinavagupta's text, that last commentary, first examines the question of whether the self exists and whether there's a permanent conscious subject, especially in response to the Buddhist objections. So as you all know, Buddhism rejects the notion of a self, says that life is like a series of moments, dharmas, that come into existence and go out of existence, well, the Abhidharma version, but there's no underlying reality, no underlying self there. So the Buddhist philosophers maintained that because of the truth of impermanence, the experience of a permanent self is mistaken. Rather, there is a series of cognitions in a flow, a santana, that gives rise to the illusion of a permanent self. But analysis proves this not to be the case. So I haven't got the references for all this, but there are. And you'll have to, we'll look it up yourself, but you'll have to take my word for it for now. Abhinavagupta engages with this argument, claiming that its fundamental error lies in not recognizing the prima facie evidence for the self in its power of knowledge or cognition, jnana shakti. So the terms I know, I knew, I shall know, past, present, and future, must be predicated upon a self-consciousness that is self-luminous. So interesting idea that consciousness is self-luminous. It's quite a modern idea, it seems to me. Old Galen Strawson and all that, talking about the luminosity of consciousness. If the self did not shine in its own light, the world would just be darkness, he says. Not only does the self illuminate objects, but through its self-consciousness illuminates itself. So it has this swasam vedana. It's self-reflexive, it illuminates itself. In such a cognition as I know, there is an awareness of external objects such as pot and mat, and this awareness is a kind of movement or vibration, spanda, that is in fact a kind of action. So the cognition that I know entails the power of action. So it's very different from the Advaita Vedanta, which is pure knowledge, because it's saying no, action is important in the world. These two powers of action and knowledge, you need both to achieve liberation, to have the veil of ignorance taken from you. So the cognition that I know entails a power of action, which is its movement towards objects that appear to be external, as Bhairava's bulging eyes move out into the world. But these external objects are in fact constituted within consciousness. The objects of perception, such as pot and mat, he's always talking about pots and mats, cannot be distinguished from our awareness because they're part of it. So pots and mats are Indian philosophy's table, because they're sitting on the ground with a pot on a mat with a pot, aren't they? So they're taking their immediate environment, as Oxford philosophers will take the table as their example. So the objects of perception, such as pot, can't be distinguished from our awareness of them because they're part of it. Because of the emphasis on the power of action as fundamental to the process of being aware, that cognition entails not only self-reflection, vimarsha, but also movement towards the objects of consciousness, which in turn come into consciousness through the senses. And Ratier has called this an ontology of the act. So vimarsha, through a mrish, to touch. So vimarsha is a kind of, I think it must be from the Indian idea of, and indeed the medieval European idea of a perception as a touching. So when we see the flowers, as a beam comes out of our eyes and touches the flowers, extramission they call it, and that was the model in medieval Europe, and it's also the model here in Samkhya and Yoga. We touch objects with our eyes. So here it's vimrish, it's reflected back. So there's you're touching yourself in your perception, self. Now the Buddhist objection might be, if the self is unchanging in its essential nature and distinct from residual traces, then memory has to be due to residual traces. So, okay, you've got these samskaras, these residual traces, vasanas, these perfumings of what went before, and that accounts for your sense of your permanent self, but really there isn't one. If this is so, memory is within residual traces. So it's not memory is within the residual traces themselves. Then the one who remembers as a distinct entity must likewise be a mere supposition, because you think of yourself as permanent, but it's really just within your latent traces and the vasanas that are carrying on through time, one after the other, bang, 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 which are so impermanent, they just last a split second, chitta matra. But everything you think of yourself is contained in each moment, but there's nothing underlying that survives, that was ever there. So if memory is constantly changing, then the one who remembers that, as constituted within memory, cannot be unchanging. That's that argument. Now, so they say, indeed, the self does not exist because it cannot be perceived. bit like Hume, you know, I look into myself, I can't find myself, where am I? And this very fact refutes the idea of the unchanging self. If in consequence of the rise of the residual traces there is a change in the self, then the self cannot be eternal. So because of the residual residues in our mind, that changes our self, so therefore we can't be eternal anyway, because the self is changing all the time. So Abhinavagupta outlines these arguments in that last work. And then he responds, Abhinavagupta responds, that various cognitions, including memories that occur at different times, must be united within a single subject of remembrance. There must be a rememberer, he argues, because experience that is remembered or being undergone in the present, or which shines in the present, must rest upon a subject. So if memory is a... if you've got the series of cognitions flying along one after the other, and they're... so you've got the perception of the flowers, and the yellow and the orange and all that, that's what's called secondary qualities. But they can't be separated from consciousness, according to the Buddhists, and so there's just consciousness. Now, according to Abhinavagupta, that might be true, but they're lakshanas, they're qualities within the stream of consciousness, and they must belong to something which supports them, to an ashraya, to something which holds those qualities. And that which holds the qualities is the self. So experience that's remembered or being undergone in the present occurs only because it rests on the subject. And the self, which is essentially an I consciousness, who am I? What is the self? I'm an I consciousness, I'm aware of myself. That must be the subject of experience of apparently external objects and therefore of memory. There must be a subject, he says, of the chain or flow of memories, and this subject is the self that we know to be unchanging. So this is, you know, he sets out the argument of the Buddhists about the unchanging self, and then he refutes it in this way, that there must be a subject of memories, really. So the Buddhist claims that this memory is simply a residual trace of past experiences, these vasanas, that the direct object of a previous experience has become the object of memory, and so there's no need to posit a permanent self. You know, you experienced something 10 minutes ago, you saw the bunch of flowers, and then that is reconstituted later on in memory, in your memory of it. But you don't need a self for that, you can just have this series of vasanas, likewise the self. Now, Abhinavagupta says, memory is a quality, a guna, and a quality can't stand alone, but must rest in something. It must rest in a substratum, in an ashraya. So this substratum is the permanent self, Atman, a self that is self-luminous. And the self can become an object of its own cognition in a reflexive awareness, as we said earlier. And as a result, the self's awareness of itself is conscious of its objects, such as memory, as being constituted within it. So cognition and memory, jnana and smriti, are powers of the self, which along with the power of discrimination allows for us to experience the differentiated world. So I've got a quote here from the text, from the Ishvara Pratibhigna Varshini. It has also to be admitted as following from our analysis, that whatever is manifested is separate from consciousness, one consciousness from another, and an object of consciousness from another object. But in reality, this separation is not possible, he says. So he's going along with the Buddhists so far, but he's rejecting the Buddhist rejection of the self. So it's called merely an appearance of separation. But this is not, for all that, deprived of ultimate reality. Appearance is that very ultimate reality of all that is created. So even the appearance is consciousness. Even what we experience, even the objects, is our consciousness. So it's kind of panpsychism. It is called differentiation because it differentiates all parts, and that appearance is the meaning of the power of exclusion, apohana. All worldly transactions are formed by that triad of powers, by knowledge, cognition, memory, and discrimination. So external or spatio-temporal objects are also part of the flow of cognitions, each cognition resting in the subject in its own unique way. Thus, pot and mat are distinct objects, as are the cognitions blue and lotus, and all these cognitions rest in the subject. Even the cognition that erases a previous cognition rests in the subject. The perception of the mother of pearl might correct the perception that this is silver, if you remember from Advaita, this very famous example, in which case the mother of pearl cognition destroys the cognition of silver, but even this relation of contraries rests in the subject or one who experiences. So that's his argument against the, one of his arguments against the Buddhist notion of self. So establishing a unified subject of cognitions is also the case with action. So we've done cognition, now we've got action. Actions such as raising the hand and letting it fall are successive, one coming after the other, and so are inseparable from time. Reminds me of in the 60s here in Oxford, you had Meldon and all these people raising their hands and writing about what it is to raise your hand. and they're doing the same thing in 10th century India. Yeah. So time is action, he says, for time is observable in the movement of the sun, in birth, and in different flowers in summer and winter. It gets quite poetic. Action is time brought about in successive experience as constituted within consciousness as an object in a way that spatial objects are so constituted. So you've got action, and you've got time, one damn thing after another, and all this helps to corroborate the notion of a permanent, unchanging self. In this way, Abhinavagupta wishes to maintain the doctrine of consciousness as the primary reality, with world, the flow of the objects of cognition, being contained with it. So the self is not individual, but the Lord who is the true subject. So it's kind of phenomenological in a way. You've got the flow of objects of experience, like the Buddhists say, and Abhinavagupta accepts that. But he's saying there's more to it than that. It's not just a flow of perceptions. There has to be for a perceiver, for a subject. And that subject is the I, which is irreducible. The I is not subject to doubt, in a sense. And it's that in which the flow of experiences rests. But, for example, a desire might arise in the mind. The self is not individual, but he's also said that self, that I, is not just me, but it's cosmic, it's a universal I. So for example, a desire might arise in my mind, let me cook, which leads to a succession of movements of the body in which the desire to cook remains unbroken. Desire manifests itself in the various movements and is itself without succession. And is Icha, that desire, is also evidence for the self. Similarly, the Lord has the will to rule, to shine, to move, and to be self-conscious, which, while appearing as a succession of manifestations, in reality is nothing other than I-consciousness in its essential nature. Now, I mean, so far so good. The Shaiva Siddhanta will be quite happy with that analysis of the self. But where they would disagree with the next move that he makes is to say that I, that sense of I, is universal, is that we all share it. There's one self, there's one I, cosmic I. He says, as in a mirror, the flow of a river might be reflected, but in reality is not different from the mirror. So the Lord's power of action, the Kriya Shakti, thus creates action characterized by a succession and is affected by action. Now, to establish this view, he must appeal not simply to argument with examples, but also to the idea of the Lord as revealed in scriptures. Now, the Buddhists would reject this, of course, but he appeals to scripture. And he must do this in order to establish not simply that the world, the flow of experiences, is constituted within consciousness, but that this consciousness is universal and shared. So the idealism of the recognition score is distinctive. It is not a non-realism, because it engages with an analysis of perception and world that is oriented towards real experiences of the Buddhist philosophy, as Buddhist philosophy had been. So it's not non-real, because it engages with an analysis of perception and world that is oriented towards real experience, but it nevertheless says that both subject and object are constituted within consciousness, which is cosmic, which is shared. But this is nevertheless a strong idealism rather than a weak idealism, because its claim that the empirical subject, along with the objects of perception, the stream of experience, are co-constituted as being within consciousness, although this consciousness is absolute, and we know that because of revealed scripture. So we can establish that the existence of the self through reasoning, but the nature of the self as cosmic and universal is shown to us through revelation. So the theism of the Shaiva Siddhanta is relegated to a way of speaking or a lower order of understanding. So that this lot accept the Shaiva Siddhanta arguments, but it's a lower level of understanding. They only go up to a certain tattva, a certain level of reality. But this non-dual understanding is trumps that, is higher. Now, while there are parallels, Abhinavagupta rejects Buddhist philosophy, including its idealistic forms, although he's quite sympathetic to the Vijnanavada, and actually quotes Yogacara texts sometimes in his Tantra Loka. But this last, final work is really a rejection of Buddhism. And he presents, you know, it's a kind of phenomenology. He sets out the Buddhist arguments, and then he critiques them from his perspective. But there's no Buddhist response. There's silence after this. I don't know why. No, but I haven't read it, I guess. Or I think Buddhism probably gets wiped out from Kashmir and by that period of the 11th century. I don't know the history well enough. But anyway, there's no Buddhist response. So, lastly then, I was thinking about this a couple of nights ago. I thought I'd do a diagram. I was thinking about what's the relationship between self or consciousness and world? And you've got different positions you can map or plot. They're a bit crude, these things, but they're, I always find them quite useful as a beginning. And so the Pratyabhijna maintains that the consciousness is universal, is shared. We share one consciousness, ahanta, I amness. And that the world is real. So the world is real, but it's pure consciousness. So though it appears to be solid and all the rest of it, it's that's our perception, that's our ignorant perception. If we had real true perception, we'd realise that it was, like me, made of consciousness. And then we've got the Advaita position, which is different from that, which says, okay, self or consciousness is universal, Sat-Chit-Ananda. Chit is part of that absolute reality. But the world is illusory, is maya, is Advaita. So it's a Vivarta, you know, that Vivarta, as you see the rope, the snake is just a rope. You see the shells are not money and not coins. You see the coins are shells. This is evidence. These are analogies for the idea of the world being maya, being illusion. If I've understood that correctly, if I've understood Shankara correctly. So I think that they're different, Pratyabhijna and Advaita. And you've also got, if you maintain the world as real, as many Indian philosophies did, like Vaisheshika, Shaiva Siddhanta and the Samkhya, I think you've got two versions there. The self is an essence, and also the self is a construction. So the self is particular, it's not universal in those philosophies. You and I are particular consciousnesses. distinct from each other, distinct from world. And the world is real in these traditions. So they're kind of dualistic. It's a kind of strong self-world dualism. I don't think it's mind. I don't think it's Cartesian dualism. It's a different kind of dualism. And I couldn't think of an example of the world being, of the self being particular, and the world being regarded as an illusion. But I think it's a limitation of a two-dimensional diagram. I think of the Yogacara. Where does the Yogacara fit? The Yogacara thinks that the world is unreal, if I remember correctly. Correct me if I'm wrong. And that the self is a construction. So the self is the world is constructed just as much as the self is. So maybe if we have self as construction, then the Yogacara could be down there. Now a map like that is just a preliminary, but it's quite interesting to map out these things in that kind of two-dimensional, crude way, because that allows you to get your bearings, your map in the field, and then to talk about particular arguments and particular positions and texts within that. So I've come to an end again.